The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 71. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I am so excited he is here. He is a man that needs no introduction whatsoever. His name is Robert Kiyosaki. Robert, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Well, I am honored, because I am your biggest fan. I am not blowing smoke. Anyway, I'm so honored to be on your program. So thank you, George.
No problem. Thank you for being here and thank you for the kind words. So I've been listening to some of your more recent interviews where you've had the opportunity to dive into your background prior to writing Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I think it's just such a fascinating background that people could learn so much from that they could apply it to their lives today in 2020. So you can you fill us in on your backstory prior to Rich Dad, Poor Dad?
Sure. You and I were talking about our education background is similar. We flunked out. I flunked out of high school twice because I can't write. And it's not that I can't write, it's the teacher didn't like what I was writing. And so for a long time, I thought my middle name was stupid. And that was and that was hard to take because my old man, the poor dad, was the head of education for Hawaii. You know, a PhD from Stanford, Northwestern, University of Chicago. And his oldest son, me, I'm flunking out of school. And it's not that I love learning. I just hated school. I think you understand what I'm saying. So with that, I knew I was a surfer. That was my biggest problem. And when the surf was up, I wasn't in class. And so something told me, and it was both both fathers said, if you don't get discipline, you know what I'm talking about? There's self-discipline and external discipline. And if you have no self-discipline, the world disciplines you. Right. So I had no self-discipline. So both dads recommended I join the Marine Corps or do something intelligent, you know. But I still need to go to college. And my poor dad, the head of education, said, I'm not going to waste my money paying for you to go to school. So he said, you're going to have to find your own way. The day you graduate, you're on your own from high school. So I applied for... I applied to my senator for a military scholarship to U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, United States Naval Academy. And although my grades were horrible, my SATs were really high. So I was accepted to both Naval Academy and Merchant Marine Academy. And I took Merchant Marine Academy simply because they're the highest paid graduates in the world. And I really wanted to sail to Tahiti anyway. They have a good surf spot out there. I mean, you know how... You're 18 years old, you're not thinking too straight. So there was a surf spot in Papeete called Ins and Outs. And I wanted to be the first of my goofy classmates to surf Ins and Outs. So it wasn't very serious, you know. And then when I graduated, I got a job with Standard Oil, very high paying. You know, my classmates in 69 were making like $120,000 a year, which was a lot of money back in 69. But the Vietnam War was still on, and my conscience got to me. And I had a teacher at the academy. His name was Aloysius A. Norton. And he was a B-17 pilot. And he got shot down twice in World War II over Germany. And he was captured once and escaped once. So I asked, I said, what was that like? He says, the greatest experience of his life. And I went, wow. So he started talking to me about life being this experience. You know, it was very philosophical. This guy was a great, and he was my English teacher, which I flunked out of school from. So I got B's from him because I loved learning from him. He inspired me to learn. With that, I joined, instead of sailing for Standard Oil, which I had the job, I joined the Marine Corps and went to fly in Vietnam. And that was the best. You know, it was horrible at times. You know, your best friends don't come back. I was a carrier pilot, so there are times you stand on the deck and your friends don't return. You know what I mean? There's a loneliness that is beyond description. And then our job was a horrible job, too. We had to killed me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But always something good happens, and that's when I, my rich dad wrote to me, and he said that Nixon had taken the dollar off the gold standard. So this was in like February 72, and he took off the gold standard August 15, 71. Mm-hmm. And he says, watch the price of gold. And then it was about 35 an ounce, and it was, I think in January or February, it was pushing almost $45. And that's what we were talking about earlier, the trend. You know, the trend was moving. So yeah. With that, my goofy co-pilot and I climbed in our helicopter. We became gold hunters. And we flew in, and we came off the carrier, turned right, headed towards North Vietnam. And there was one problem. The gold mine we were after had already fallen into enemy hands. So we had to go in behind enemy lines. And this is not bullshit. I actually did all the stupid stuff. I went looking for gold, and we fly into this Viet Cong. They weren't Viet. You know, they was bullshit. You know what I mean? One day they're friends, next day they're not.
Right.
So we walk through this village. I go up to this gold mine, and this little Vietnamese woman is selling gold. I wrote about my book Fate because it's when I tuned into our world, which is macroeconomics. You know, she turned me on, you know. So I'm standing in front of this little bamboo shack, and this woman's about 5'1". She's got red teeth. And my co-pilot and I, who are now business partners, we're unarmed because we didn't want to piss off the Viet Cong. You know what I mean? We said, hey, we come as capitalists, not as Marines, you know. And we're negotiating for gold. And the trouble is, back in 72, it was illegal for Americans to own gold. I didn't know that. So she shows this little plastic vial, you know, and it's got looked like little raisins painted gold. And I turned to my business partner, my co-pilot, and I said, is this gold? He says, I thought you knew. You know the feeling, right?
Right.
When you have an idiot for a business partner. So there were two idiots standing in front of this woman who's laughing at us because we're the big Americans with, you know, Yankee dollars. And we don't even know what gold is.
Right.
So we're standing there. And he said, I thought you knew what gold was. No, I thought you did. F you son of a bitch. I thought we're going to die today. You don't even know what gold is. You know? So that's how I became a gold bug. And that's how I got interested in macroeconomics. Because that woman, I don't think she went to Harvard. You know what I mean?
Right.
I tried to knock her down from... I wanted to get the gold at about $42. She just laughed. She just laughed at me. She said, spot 48. I said, what's spot? And that's the price of gold all around the world in dollars every day of the year. I mean, she knew more about the macroeconomics of life, of the markets, than I did.
Yeah, she knew more about real money.
And that's what's, you know, you've had your wake-up calls. I've had my wake-up calls, you know. And that's what I said. My middle name was Stupid. Well, I found out how stupid I was. And then we had to run back to our helicopter because my crew chief was screaming. And he was screaming. I thought, oh, God, we're going to die today. And I could see the NVA, you know, we'd be like this or get shot. And what happened is I parked my helicopter on a rice paddy. I didn't know it. And my damn helicopter was sinking.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No. And so my little crew chief, he looked like Woody Allen, little tiny guy. And he's holding up the tail boom. And he says, Lieutenant, we got to get out of here. We're going to sink. I said, so the pilots were bigger than the crew chief. So we get behind, we push on the tail boom. And the little crew chief jumps in. And he starts the engine. And all this mud starts to fly. And we're getting covered in mud. And we're rocking the tail boom.
Yeah.
Get out of the mud, and it finally gets it into a hover, and we jump in, and we fly back to the carrier, and we're covered in mud, the aircraft's covered in mud, business partnership was dissolved, and we land back on the carrier, and everybody says, where the hell have you guys been? You know, this thing is completely covered in mud, we're covered, but we said, don't ask us, and we ran back in, but that's where it started, George, and then the carrier sails into Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, I start looking for gold. was he could buy gold in Hong Kong, but Americans couldn't buy it. That really twigged my brain. You know, I mean, I was curious.
Yeah.
So I found Krugerrand. I paid about $50 for it. I still have that Krugerrand today. You know, it's now worth about $2,000 or $1,850 today. So that's how I understood money. Because gold is real money, God's money. And the U.S. dollar is fake money. That's what happened in 71 when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard. Today, you know, they're printing money like there's no tomorrow. There is. Can you believe that? And people are still trying to save money. I said, are you nuts? So that's why in Rich Dad Poor Dad, I said, savers are losers. Your house is not an asset. And what else? I said, oh, yeah, rich don't work for money and all those things. But we don't teach our kids anything about money at school. And when I retired, I retired at 47. Kim was 37. And I thought it best we give back what we learned. So I wrote this goofy little book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which was turned down by every publisher on planet Earth. They said, you don't know what you're talking about. I said, and 2 years later, Oprah had me on her show.
Yeah.
This is history. All of a sudden, I became a genius. So I went from stupid to genius.
What was your motivation to write that book? I didn't realize you wrote that after you had retired.
Yeah. No, it's this is my book here. It's called Rich Dad's Prophecy.
Yeah.
I started writing this in 1999 because I was in Thailand for the Thai baht crash. And then I could see the trend coming. From 71, you know what I mean, that money had become fiat money. And they were printing it like crazy. And money was making people poor. And there was booms and busts and bubbles and all this. So Prophecy was about the biggest stock market crash in history coming in 2016. So I was 16 years out. So that the subtitles is why the biggest stock market crash in history is still coming. How you can prepare for and profit from it. The crash I was talking about here was the dot-com crash. And as you know, then came the subprime crash.
Yeah.
Then came March 2020 when the Dow crashed, the biggest crash in history. So this was, you know, just prophetic at that point. And that's what we're talking about at the break. It's one of the most important things for an investor is to study history. So then you can see what's coming.
You had the opportunity to be right in the thick of things in the 1970s and see this stagflation that most of us just kind of read about, or it's just something, especially for millennials or younger investors nowadays, they just think as though it's inflation is something that can never happen to us. It can never happen to the United States because we've never seen it. And yeah, it might have happened in the 70s, but my goodness, that was back with black and white TV, and it could never happen today with MMT and with what we know about the modern monetary system. Of course, we can never see that. But how was it to live through the 1970s when prices were going up at 6%, 10%, 12% per year? And then the next part of that question would be, have you seen similar price increases in what you buy on a day-to-day basis from 2008 to 2020?
Well, the big change, again, let's go back to the 70s because that affects how I see it. That was 72, and then Nixon opened the door to China in 74, I believe. And then in 75, gold became, you know, this guy named Blanchard made gold legal again in America. And so the door to China was open. So the reason we don't have much inflation, although they started printing money, was Chinese goods. You know, Walmart shoppers love China. So the Chinese low labor costs and all that kept inflation down for, let's say, the average person. But for the professional investor, you know, and I know there was bubbles all over the place, right? You know, there was the bubble that, you know, the subprime bubble. That was massive.
Right.
And then just recently we had the, the subprime crash in 2019. And the average person doesn't see it. They see this bubble in the stock market. But I saw the bubble in the repo market or the shadow market, and then the stock market kept going up, and all the idiots were rushing in. And as you know, as you get older, you know, the higher the market, the more stupid the investor, because they come in in droves. They come in droves, only to get slaughtered. And so the reason I was thanking you that you're my hero is a lot of the things, I'm not kidding you, nobody can take the shadow banking system and make it so simple to understand. I've been trying to figure out what you've been displaying on the board for 20, 30 years. And you go, this line goes here, I go, I have only one question, which I haven't understood yet.
Yeah.
What's a MILF?
I don't know if I can answer that question right here, Robert. We'll try to keep it family friendly. It's what is it? Money market funding. We'll go with the Fed's version of MILF, right?
Yeah. But what you were talking about, since my degree is in oil, Standard Oil. That's why I work. I drove tankers for them, a third officer. And the way you describe it perfectly is the monetary system is nothing more than a series of pipes. That's like a massive oil refinery. All these pipes running all over the place. So every time I'm watching your programs, and I recommend your programs to everybody to understand the macro or the invisible macro underneath the stock market. So what you're drawing is a diagram of a refinery, oil refinery, just massive pipes. So every time you're drawing those lines, my brain is computing. The reason I want to thank you is because it was, you know, like your confirmation bias by, I think it was about May of last year. Everybody was running into the stock market. And then I think you were talking about the repo market. And I said, I'd better get out. And I don't flip property. I have a lot of real estate.
Yeah.
But because of your program and a few other guys too, I said I better start exiting now because I think the party's over. And what we did was we had 8,000 rental units. We sold off 1,000. We sold, I hate to say this, the junk. Wow. We sold our non-performing. Do you know what I mean? We trimmed the hedge back, the stuff that wasn't performing. You know, we just didn't foresee certain things. But because of your work and people like you on YouTube, I said, okay, I better start moving. So we sold in the summer of 2019. And then because of you, you started talking about the shadow banking and the repo market and MILFs and all this other stuff. And then we could see this crash. And then as I said here, prophecy, why the biggest stock market crash in history is still coming. It came in March 2020. It went down in three massive steps.
Yeah.
And people who didn't see it got wiped out. They're being wiped out right now.
And I want to make sure that everyone understands that the rebuttal is, you couldn't have seen the virus coming. It was just this total black swan event. But the people who say that are really missing the point. And I think that the point you most likely made in your book is that the system itself is structurally flawed. And just because we have a virus or we have a mortgage-backed security crisis or a housing crisis or a dot-com bust, that's just what you see on the surface. When you look underneath, it's just like a wave, right? You just see the tippy top on the surface and you think that's the wave. But you look underneath and you're like, this is a lot more screwed up than I actually thought it was just by looking at a dot-com bust, an inflated housing bubble, or this virus that we have. People have to look beneath the surface. And to your point, look at the plumbing of the system and figure out why the plumbing isn't working, why the Fed has to come in and take their balance sheet to $7 trillion. Why do they have to do that? Why do interest rates in the United States have to be at 0%? Why couldn't Jerome Powell raise interest rates above, let's call it 2.25% without the whole thing crashing down? It's because the point you made in your book is that the system is flawed. It's too fragile. It's not based on the economy anymore. We've financialized everything to where now the tail is wagging the dog.
But you know, going back to your question, did I see hyperinflation? Yeah, in the stock market, real estate market, bond market. I could see it all over. But Mr. and Mrs. Walmart shopper was happy taking low price goods from China, and then China was buying our bonds, you know what I mean? But Mr. and Mrs. Average or the middle class could not see it.
Was the inflation back in the 1970s much more noticeable for the people shopping at Walmart and Target of or Kmart or whatever it was back then?
It was a lot more noticeable because China hadn't come on yet.
Right.
When you talk about how fast was it changing? You know, I was living in Honolulu in the 70s. Go to a restaurant and they had to have like little stickers because the price of food was changing every single day.
Oh, yeah.
You go in and said, you know, can I have a hamburger? Well, today it's a dollar, and they go in the next day it's $1.20, $1.30. They kept changing the price. That's how we understood inflation. And what you're saying is the average person, the millennials and Gen X and all this, they haven't seen that. And I agree with you 100%. It's coming. It's coming so big that we might go back to the Weimar Republic with hyperinflation or Venezuela or Zimbabwe. And I don't think we're ready for it because, you know, like I said, I was a surfer. And so 71, when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, that was like the first wave that started. Then China joins, you know, China comes unglued, gold comes off the gold standard, you know, and they everything starts to change. And every this small wave surfers, a small wave surfer rides shore break, and that's wind-driven waves. But I had fantasies, and that's all they were, fantasies of being a big wave surfer. And those are the ocean swells that come out of Alaska. Yeah. So when they hit Hawaii, they're massive. And every surfer has got to be cognizant of the feeling inside the wave pattern. So you paddle out, so you see the first wave, and you better catch that second wave. Because if you don't catch that second wave, the third wave is going to take you out. And if you wait for the third wave, you'd better be quick, drop in. So what happened, what I saw when Corona appeared, I go, oh, there's a black swan or a red swan, whatever you want to call it. And that was the third wave. The third swell cleaned everybody out. And I was on Wolf Blitzer in January of 2008. You can check it at the Rich Dad site. I was saying, the biggest stock market crash is coming. This is January 2008. And they said, so Wolf asked me, I said, well, Lehman's going down, Lehman Brothers. And Lehman went down September 2008.
You're really that worried about Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers?
Yes. I'm afraid the Federal Reserve will eventually or come close to bailing them out.
The people, if they had listened, they'd be out. But people said, you don't know what you're talking about. But I just, and I'm trying to blow smoke, but what you're showing the world in rebel capitalists is the internal mechanism of what's generating the waves. You're the wave generator. And so when I saw repo start going down in September 2019, it was another confirmation. So we had sold off about 1,000 units, stuck all that, went back to cash. We don't like to flip, we'd rather hold.
Yeah.
So we're doing fine. And other businesses are doing fine. But you said it exactly correct on Marin Katusa about the swaps and all that. The average guy is not paying attention to it.
Yeah.
You know, my friend just sold his business for $1.8 billion. He has no idea what the repo market is. So how did you get so far? But they don't know. They know school districts, like you said. They know interest rates. But that's about it. And they couldn't see this crash coming.
What happens in the next 3 years, 5 years, when the political narrative in the United States changes completely? And now all of a sudden, we don't want our stuff made in China. We don't want to give them the leverage over us to create and produce our medical masks, as an example, or our pharmaceuticals. And then let's say the virus has the effect of breaking down global supply chains, while at the same time, you have this narrative bringing supply chains back to the United States. Now, all of a sudden, we're right back to the 1970s in the sense we don't have the global supply chains to give us cheap goods. So we've got to make everything here. A lot of people would say that's a good thing. It can be good and bad, but it takes us back to the 1970s where prices that you see at Walmart and Target start going up dramatically. And you combine that with helicopter money, if the Fed or the government spends more money bringing it down into the real economy, creating excess demand while you're reducing the amount of supply.
Yeah, and again, you said it with Marion Cotillard, says the average guy is not even, they're not even, there's microeconomics and macro. Most people are mini. They're not even paying attention to anything. So, you know, there's no inflation. Well, what about the cost of a college education? What about home prices? What about the stock market? What about the bond market? Everything was in a bubble, but people were shopping at Walmart. And they were happy because price of a hamburger at McDonald's was stable. And the only reason that happened is because the Fed was printing trillions of dollars to cover, or hundreds of millions, to cover up for the lack of production in America. Right. So now that the wave has crashed, people are saying, well, we should bring our factories on shore, which is good, but that's 4 or 5 years out. I mean, even Rich Dad, we're already in process. We're going to bring manufacturing on shore just because it wasn't much advantage of doing business in China. So anyway, things are changing so fast. That's what you're asking, is people are not paying attention. And I think, you know, this debt, we're the biggest debtor nation in the world, possibly in history. Possibly. You know, if it's measured in dollars, we have quadrillion in derivatives, $265 trillion in debt. Every emerging market is beholden to us. So the dollar stays strong. So Americans are saying, well, you know, it's going to be a little V recovery. I don't think so. I think what's going to happen is we're going to go into hyper, not this year or next year, but it's coming. And that's going to set up a whole nother storm. And at the same time, we have pensions are bankrupt. And the old guys like me, you know, 401k guys, we're toast. So it's more than MMT or socialized money. Is we have to go to Zimbabwe.
On this note, Robert, I'd love for you to expand on your most recent book, which was Who Stole My Pension? And I think it really plays into what we're talking about. Oh, there it is right there.
Now, it's my whole gig, because when I came back from Vietnam, I came back in January of 73. And my poor dad, you know, he was unemployed. He had no job, no paycheck, no pension. And again, like that little Vietnamese woman who wouldn't sell me gold because I was an idiot. How can a man with a PhD, honest, is, you know, very, very good, hardworking man, be unemployed, no job, no pension? And again, I said, maybe I'm seeing the future. And so my poor dad, being an academic type, he says, well, are you going to stay in the Marine Corps for a career? I said, no. Are you going to fly for United? I said, no. Are you going to go back to sail for Standard Oil? They're all high-paying jobs. I said, no, something told me I had to become an entrepreneur. Because the future today is extremely bright for an entrepreneur. You know, every time I hold up my little cell phone, you know, back in 73, we didn't have anything like that. I had quarters in my pocket. You know, yet that cell phone is the most powerful tool of any entrepreneur in history. And these yo-yos can't make a buck. If I had that little cell phone, it could magnify my brain power. I could sell throughout the world and all this. You know, that's what you're doing, what I'm doing right now. That cell phone gave all of us so much power. But our schools are still telling us to get a job and save money and get out of debt and invest in the stock market. That's why the kids are getting wiped out. Yeah. There's no financial education in schools. Entrepreneur education. Yeah.
And talk about the pensions that the baby boomers, you know, we have this glut of population that is retiring. They're dependent, a lot of them, unfortunately, on Social Security, on their state pension fund. But these pension funds are just drastically underfunded. And they, you know, let's say they're only 50% funded, like in the California, Illinois, New Jersey, and they need to get a 7% return just to meet their liabilities. So they've got to go further and further and further out the risk curve, Where when before, when the Fed just, when we had, let's call it normal interest rates, before the Fed dropped it to zero, they could just buy treasuries, something safer, get that type of return. But now they've got to buy corporate debt. They got to buy junk debt. They have to buy private equity. They have to buy Uber, Tesla. They have to invest in WeWork and all these crazy companies. And it's a result of the Fed. Can you expand on that a little?
Well, thanks for reminding me. A lot of things happened in 71. It was Nixon, the dollar off the gold standard. And then came China opening. But same was the end of a defined benefit pension plan. So until then, if I had stayed with Standard Oil, I would have got a pension for life. You know, a defined benefit is a paycheck for life. Well, they cut that in 74 or 75 when they started ERISA, Employee Retirement Income Security Act. So with that came the 401k, IRA, SEP, and all this. Basically, they said the moment you leave your job, you know, you're on your own. So that's why the story goes, who stole my pension here, is I kind of woke up with my poor dad. The government cut his pension. PhD. Good man. Never cheated on, you know, never cheated on my mother. Drank a little bit, but that was about it.
Yeah.
And he couldn't find a job. He couldn't find a job. So I'm standing there going like this. And yet we have those, the Buddhists call it some kind of moment, you know, Satori moment. You go, oh. And you see the future. And I said, this is going to happen to my generation.
Yeah.
And so most of my friends got jobs with Eastern Airlines, which is gone. You know, but the bulk of them got, they're really happy. They got hired by Pan Am and United. Pan Am's gone. United's pension was taken over in 2009, I think. So all my friends who are pilots with these high paying, they're making about $300,000 a year, which is a lot of money for them. They don't have pensions. They don't have anything. So the guys with the 401k are toast too. Because, you know, if this market keeps crashing, they're gone. And then Kentucky, you know, Mitch McConnell, senator, just whispered the word bankruptcy. And the Democrats took off on that because Kentucky's teachers, firefighters, and police officers' pensions went 16% funded. 9% funded in March of 2020. They went single digit. So that's why when, I don't know what McConnell meant, but he said bankruptcy. That might be a way of saying to every teacher, firefighter, and police officer, adios.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't happen, but that's where we are as you and I speak right now. Pensions are going broke all over the world.
Yeah.
All over the world.
And while at the same time, I think people are also relying on Social Security. Basically, what happens is Social Security is tied to the rate of inflation, but they're now changing the way they measure inflation once again. So, and they're pegging the Social Security not just to the CPI, but a different unit of measurement that, of course, you, like you'd expect, measures inflation lower than the CPI. I think that they're just going to have, they're going to peg the CPI to where it's much lower than the in the real economy. And so the purchasing power that you're getting with that Social Security check is just going to continue to go down while at the same time your pension's disappearing.
Correct. You know, it's a pay-go or pay-go scheme, got to pay as you go, but it's really a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
It always depends on a younger worker contributing for the old guys today. So Social Security is gone. Medicare is going to go bust. Because of the, you know, healthcare is through the roof right now, all the pharmaceuticals. So that's why when I was watching you with all your programs, with Maren, you know, Katusa talking about swaps, I'm going, holy shit. And it's exactly as you said. People should go see that show. Because you said it exactly. Most people are not paying attention. They don't know what you and I are talking about right now. But if you watch those trends and all that, you can see it. So this is my pick. You know, what you were saying, what Maren was saying, is gold is going to be the best today. There is no, probably Bitcoin too, and silver. But with hyperinflation coming and the swap lines getting cut down to, you know, different countries like Papua New Guinea, gold's going to become scarcer too.
Yeah, physical.
Physical. So we're hitting. So if gold keeps going up, and all the governments have to print more money, and less gold is entering the marketplace, oil is dropping, bankruptcy is going through the roof. Question is, are they going to print or not print? And I think not only was March 2020 the biggest crash, I don't think we started printing yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It might be a Weimar Republic.
I don't think Americans realize that they are in the same position as a Barrick Gold in the United States, in the sense that the government is going to look around and says, who has the resources here? Oh, it's the people who own houses. Oh, it's the producers. It's the guys or gals with, that have cash flowing businesses, the people that really create the job. Let's go after them because they have the money. So, I mean, do you see it playing out like that in the United States from a tax standpoint? And if so, I know you've done a lot to structure your own portfolio to minimize taxes. And so I guess if you could expand on that, it'd be awesome.
Right. You cover a marriage show also, is that there's rent control coming in.
Yeah.
And they're going to raise real estate taxes. So that's going to freeze guys like you and I out, which only means we have to get all it means to me is we got to get smarter.
Yeah.
And you know, when I hold up a cell phone to young people, I say, this is to leverage your brain. This little iPhone leverages your thoughts. You have more power today to be the best. You have a global entrepreneur. When you look at the macro, in the next 10 years, 2020 to 2030, 2 billion people will turn 65. 2 billion out of 7.5 billion. You know, and that's going to cause the ripple effect when things happen. It was just like in 71 when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard. It's set up today, 2020. Now that it's going to go down, people are saying, well, it's going to be a V. I think it's an L. But the good news is, with the right, like what we're doing right now and with that little iPhone, you don't have to be a victim of what's coming. You know, there's more opportunity today. But it's between your left ear and your right ear.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to expand on that, because let's go back to Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And you had a brilliant way of describing that on one of your recent videos I watched, where you didn't describe it just as most people see it. Oh, I just wrote a book and I just put it out there and I happened to go on Oprah and it took off and the rest is history. You see a book as an asset that produces cash flow. And I think that if people could see the internet, and to your point, their cell phones, as a vehicle that they themselves could produce assets that produce cash flow the same way you did with Rich Dad, Poor Dad, it would change their mindset. And then also, if you could talk about if you were a young person today, or anyone for that matter, and you were writing a Rich Dad, Poor Dad, or you're creating an asset, a content form of asset that would cash flow, wouldn't it be far easier to get that book out there now with the internet and with YouTube and with podcasting and with blogging than it was back in the 90s when you first got into the game?
It's so effing easy, I can't stand it. I'm a complete technosaurus wreck. I don't know how to use my cell phone. Excuse my allergies yet. But I make about $25,000 a month on YouTube. It's just because, like you and me, I just want to teach. And so in one of my tweets, I said, the best teachers are now on YouTube, you know, like us. And we attract from all over the world. It's just how you look at stuff, you know. You could be watching the Kardashians, or you could be watching George Gammon or Robert Kiyosaki. It's up to you. But today, it's more set that it's never been easier. That's my opinion. But if you look at my balance sheet, you know, Rich Dad Poor Dad is a book on accounting. That's all it is. Income statement, balance sheet, statement of cash flow. It's my top assets are intellectual property.
Right.
IP. right? So I publish a book. I sell a license to 50 publishers throughout the world. Day one, I'm positive. So it may take me 2 years to write a book, let's say. It cost me $50,000, but I sell 50 licenses for $10,000 each. I'm in the money. And I have my cash flow game. Our cash flow games are blowing out. That's a 25-year-old game. And they're just blowing out the door and all this. And I'm up here in my mountain cabin and thinking about the next entrepreneurial venture. But with that cash flow from my IP, I lever up with debt to buy RP, real estate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's say I make $1 million in IP, and I have to find a property that's worth $5 million. That means I'm going to borrow $4 million. So I've now stepped up my depreciable basis to $5 million. So I'm depreciating $5 million instead of $1 million, and I'm paying no taxes on the $1 million, and I'm getting cash flow, and with the extra income, I'm buying gold and silver.
One of my final questions, Robert, is what keeps you going? Because you always talk about, and I totally agree, how it's all about between it's all about what is between this ear and this ear. It's all about what's in your mind. So from someone who has trained themselves through experience, life experience, through wars, through having success and failures as an entrepreneur, and you still wake up every single day motivated to do your podcast, to invest in real estate. Now you're excited about another crash where you can go borrow another $300 million and take it to the next level. Why do you do it? What motivates you?
Well, it's like, it's a game. It's like you love golf. And while we're in the break, My wife is the avid golfer. You know, she just loves the long ball. She can hit, you know.
Yeah.
And it's her game. And for me, my game was rugby.
Okay.
But if you don't love the game, don't play.
Right.
And it doesn't mean you always win. You know, I mean, you have good days and you have bad days. But I just found my game. And I think what you and I are doing is we're only teaching what we wanted to learn ourselves.
Exactly right. 100%.
All it is. So when the story of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, when I was 9 years old, and I asked my school teachers, what am I going to learn about money? We don't teach money at school. I said, so why am I in school? And that kind of set up my curiosity. You know, they say curiosity kills a cat. So I'm watching your stuff because the system, the study of money is such a pervasive, massive, global subject. And anybody says they know it all, you know they don't know it. So really, that's it. And but for people, I just, you know, I only invest in what I love too. Like I don't have stocks, bonds, mutual funds, or ETFs. I don't love them, but I love my property. You know, I love the stuff I have. I have little oil wells, and it's just fun for me. Yeah. It's just a game. And my Rich Dad always said to me, "This is a million ways to financial heaven." There's a billion ways to financial hell too. You know, and you better figure out which way you want to go. And as you and I know, a lot of people are in hell today. I feel for them.
Yeah.
But we've been there.
But to your point, there's more opportunity today to get them on the right path and to get on the, you know, get to where they want to be financially. There's far, even going back to 2004, 2005, I remember one of the businesses I set up that did well. This was back in the early days. I had $100,000 to my name, and I had to borrow $400,000 because I had to have $500,000 to set up this business, which I built it up and it became successful. I had over 100 employees, but if I look at the amount of cash flow the business actually threw off compared to what you could do today by just starting a website or starting a YouTube channel or a podcast like yours. I mean, look at your startup costs. You've got $500,000 to this brick and mortar location to just buying a microphone, a computer, and throwing out content that you're really passionate about. And, that you're still producing today just gets you out of bed. It gets you excited. It gets you fired up. And it might not be financial education. It might not be macroeconomics. But regardless, everyone's got something that really gets their juices flowing. In today's day and age, you can leverage that to turn it into digital assets that pay you to own them, that you can parlay into real estate, precious metals, into God's money, whatever you choose.
Well, and you can do it all over the world, yeah, sitting in front of your iPhone. You know, what leverage? What leverage? I just can't believe not everybody's doing it. So it's just... Another thing, too, is you don't have to be the lone ranger. Like you mentioned your team. I have a great team, but we're all on the same team. You know, we want the same things for our customers. We study together. We call ourselves like a holistic learning unit. We have accountants, attorneys. We're always learning together. And if you don't love learning, then you better find out what you do love learning. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I said, I flunked out of high school twice because I can't write. Well, once I found out what I wanted to learn, there was no stopping me. You know, I get up to learn. I don't get up to go to work. I get up to learn. Look, looking forward to talking to you, you know, tell you, you know, anybody who doesn't see what George Gammon is doing, it better wake up. Because like I said, the old Marion Katusa, I went, holy moly, you know. I've studied this subject so much. And it's just the most exciting game. And Kim and I have been homeless. You know, we know what it feels like. We appreciate that. But as Nassim Taleb says, you know, that either fragile, robust, or anti-fragile.
Right.
And, you know, a fragile person is like a champagne flute. You hit it, they shatter, they're screwed. A robust person is like a granite rock. You can pound on him all day. He'll still be there. Nothing's going to change. But an anti-fragile person, no matter how much pressure you put on them, they get smarter and better. And that's the entrepreneur.
And that's why I wanted to bring up your stories about when you were in the war. And it just reminded me of my father when he was in World War II. And he had that same type of attitude. And I see it exactly playing out in you. And I saw it in him. It's just this anti-fragile mentality that no matter what happens, you just can't keep them down. They get right back up. And they keep going. They're like the Energizer Bunny. They just keep going and going and going. You can't stop them. And sooner or later, they will become successful. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Yep. You know, and my wife, Kim, and I, we study a lot of metaphysical things too, you know, like spiritual things. So you have your mind, you have your body, you have your emotions, which are very powerful. You know, most people are terrified, so they don't learn very much. But it's also your spirit, and that's what the Marine Corps taught me, was the spirit of your team, your men. You know, I didn't hate my enemy. You know, they had spiritual words like mission, duty, honor, code, respect. You know, things like that are spiritual words, and that seems to have been lost in our society today.
Yeah.
You know, you don't gossip behind people's back, say it to them face to face, be respectful. It's missing. And people are more fragile. It'll hurt my feelings. So, you know, but that's for guys like us, or anybody who's anti-fragile, it's the best time. Because the fragile people are just breaking up right now. Oh, what do they call them? Trigger events. I got to go to a safe room. So have a good time. But so much fun. You know, when you told me you had Medellin, I'm going, God, I love that place. You know, I mean, Colombia has the most beautiful women on earth. You know, I know why you're there.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm here for the macroeconomics, Robert. Let's get it straight. I'm here because the currency is cheap real estate, all that. We'll talk about that when we stop recording, buddy.
it's just this adventure. You know, and I was watching 60 Minutes last night. This woman, so I just graduated from school and I don't have a job. I feel for her.
Yeah.
You know, we've all been there. But does she go forward or does she get fragile? That's her choice.
All right, Robert. Well, I want to be cognizant of your time. So for anyone who wants to find out more about the teaching you do, where can they go?
Well, Rich Dad Poor Dad was started with a game called the cash flow. So every time you're drawing your little diagrams on your board, those are cash flow pipes.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you don't control your cash flow, you're screwed. Because cash is either flowing in or it's flowing out, or it's going to the government, or it's going to your mortgages and all this. Those are all little pipes. So we created this cash flow board game because my rich dad taught me how to be rich playing Monopoly. And you and I and everybody in the world knows the same formula for Monopoly. 4 greenhouses, 1031 red hotel. That's the game. So I own thousands of red little greenhouses. You know, Jerry Colangelo and I are partners in the Biltmore and the Wigwam. We just play Monopoly. You know, and so that's it. It's just this game. But people, you know, I know it's serious. Money's a serious game. But if you don't want to learn it, then I don't know what to say to people. It's just this fun game. It's Monopoly.
But you have all those resources. You have all those resources on your website, correct? Which is richdad.com. And then your podcast. I'd strongly suggest people listen to your podcast, because not only do you have entrepreneurs on there, but you have mindset people, and you also have macro guys. I think you have Rickards on there. You probably had Schiff. I know you've got a lot of, and by the way, you might even have me on there sometime soon. Well, I think in the next couple of days here, to throw in a plug for that.
I know. It's learning is the most, you know, YouTube is the best, because you get people who like learning. That's what I love about it. And I learn from everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm looking forward to talking to you about, you know, because I'm not blowing smoke. Every time I watch your show, I'm going, holy mackerel. I understand more about the plumbing or cash flow, and that's the game. And the average person who's hurting right now is because the cash stopped flowing in. It's flowing out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the difference.
Yeah, and the entrepreneur is the person, or the investor on that side of the quadrant, is the person that has just more control over that cash flow than the employee. The employee has no control over their cash flow. They're at the mercy of another entity, another person, or a government.
Right. And, you know, with gold, the word is counterparty risk. So if you're working for an employer, you're only as good as your employer. You know, a lot of people found out their employer was not worth it. They weren't really good. Whereas my employees are happy because our business is still sailing. You know, we're making more money than ever before. They're going to make more money. So these are all lessons in life that this time, you know, this coronavirus, we call this invasive virus pandemic, is a time to look at yourself, look in the mirror. Say, what am I learning right now? Because that's, I've done it so many times and I've had no money. You know, when Kim and I were homeless, I had to look in the mirror. It's not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
I've either got to shape up or get out.
You don't know this, but in 2009, I lost pretty much everything I had. And it wasn't because of the economy. It was because I got into a big battle with a couple politicians. And I learned the hard way that, no matter how much money you have, no matter how good of a lawyer you have, you're always going to lose that battle. And I lost big time. And fortunately, the business was still profitable. So I took on partners for capital and brought it back up. But there's nothing like I've been extremely poor. I grew up poor. And it's a different feeling when you go from making a little bit of money to going back to poor and looking at yourself in the mirror. That's when you really got to put on your anti-fragile face and go out there and start kicking ass, because it's a lot harder to go from rich to poor back to rich than it is to go from poor to rich from an emotional standpoint. And I'm so glad I was able to go through that and come out the other side, because just like the war that my father fought or the war that you fought, it just makes you so much better of a person moving forward.
Right. And anyway, it's an honor to be in your program, and you know, thank you very much, and I look forward to interviewing on my program. But this is the most fantastic time to be alive, as far as I'm concerned, and we've both been there with nothing.
Yeah.
And sometimes nothing is a good starting point, you know. When I met Kim, I was $850,000 in debt in the consumer. I mean, I owed my investors $850,000, and she's still married. She says, we'll work our way out of this. And that's why we're rich today, because we found that we turned our mistakes into lessons. And that's all life is, just lesson after lesson, mistake, lesson, mistake, lesson.
Yeah. Okay. So here's my last question, I promise. Who is more anti-fragile, you or Kim?
Kim.
Kim's the rock, huh?
She's the reason I'm here. I wouldn't be here without her. you know, she was a blessing and all this. And because she's stable, I'm unstable. You know, I mean, I'm running off. I'm an entrepreneur. Yeah. I can't. I have ADD. If you look up in the dictionary, ADD, it's my picture in there.
Yeah.
But she keeps it on track and integrates the stuff. She runs all of her. My business partners call her. They don't call me. Because George, most of the time, I'm watching guys like you on YouTube. I'm not kidding. I'm going, what did he say? It's so fascinating, you know. I never was a student, but now I'm a student. So that's. I can leave somebody with a thought is find that student in you where you just want to learn and learn and share what you learn. You have to want to share too, you know?
All right, Robert. Well, I could go on forever. We'll leave it there. I just sincerely appreciate your time. It was an honor to talk to you and I cannot wait to do it again.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And thank you for all the guidance you've given me. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.